Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. Lawmakers have returned to Washington this week in time to deal with the fallout from last weekend's U.S. military action in Venezuela. Another possible government shutdown is looming. Plus, all eyes are turning to the 2026 midterm elections. President Trump's targeted immigration enforcement was also big news in 2025, including an increased ICE presence in Columbus just before the holidays. And now yesterday, more news, as an ICE officer fatally shot a 37-year-old woman in Minnesota. Joining us to talk about national politics is Ken Rudin, host of the Political Junkie podcast. Welcome back, Ken.
Good morning, Amy. Thank you.
So let's start with the news from yesterday. An ICE officer fatally shot a woman in her car as she drove away. The video is confusing. Federal and local officials are in dispute over what happened. There's been a lot of heated rhetoric over ICE. What do you make of this incident yesterday?
Well, first of all, there's a lot going on in Minnesota to begin with, because there's been an ongoing scandal involving Somali Americans and fraud. And so Donald Trump has been on the warpath against Governor Tim Walz for the longest time. But what happened yesterday was, it seems like there was this woman who was in a car, perhaps trying to block an ICE operation in the street, and the ICE agents told her to move, and instead she decided to drive away. And as she started to drive away from, we all saw this video, and there were many perhaps different interpretations of what we saw, and we may not have seen everything. But what we seem to have seen is that as she drove away, one of the ICE agents just fired three times into the windshield, perhaps killing her instantly. And there's just tremendous outrage. I mean, even if she was trying to escape a nice traffic stop, you don't shoot to kill. I mean, I assume you don't. But It's interesting to see the kind of reaction you've gotten from the government, from Kristi Noem, to the President Trump called her a deranged person. The administration is calling her a terrorist, and meanwhile, it's just remarkable that's the response you get from the government. Where, and I'm sorry to draw this sentence going on forever, but one might think of Ashley Babbitt, the woman who was killed trying to break into the Capitol on January 6th, 5 years ago, 2021. And when she was killed, President Trump called her a martyr and a great American. So it depends. The justice system is very interesting. Who gets killed by agents, and who's the good guys and who are the bad guys?
Yeah, and Kristi Noem is saying that the agent feared for his life, that the car was driving into him, and he thought he was going to get hit by the car.
And that's not what the video shows.
Right. And it all happens very quickly, because... But basically, it started as they were asking her to move her car. Then they were asking her to get out of the car. So it's like two different things. So once they asked her to get out of her car, that's when she was moving her car. Anyway.
Well, one of the agents was pulling at the door to pull her out. And as a black woman, and, the ICE agent, she said, I don't know if race or anything has to do with it, but she decided to drive away, and that's when they shot into her car. And then I watched the interpretation on Fox News, and Jesse Waters said, well, she was a lesbian the things that they were talking about on Fox News was just disgraceful. And they make these people out not as people, but as just pawns in their ideological game. So it's just really, it was upsetting, and it's been going on in many cities around the country about the use of troops, many of them masked, against American citizens. And this is not like these are not terrorists, and these are not illegal people here illegally. These are just somebody who's just trying to. Even if they were demonstrating, the fact that you just shoot to kill is just beyond belief.
Minnesota has the largest Somali population in the U.S., but there's a Columbus connection here because Columbus has the second largest Somali population. And I did a show on this topic, and it was said to watch what happens in Minneapolis because Columbus could be next. And we did see an increase in ICE activity right before the holidays here in Columbus. So what do you make of the administration singling out Somali, the Somali American community so much recently?
Well, you know, of course, Donald Trump has called Somalia an S-hole country without using the word on the air. I mean, he's disparaged the country. He disparaged the people who are here. They say they don't belong in our country. Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, right in Minnesota, is Somali American, and he's just, you know, called her, you know, a disgrace and worse things. And so he's had it out for the Somali community from the beginning. That's not to say that Somali Americans are not involved in this scandal in Minnesota, and they are. 90 people have been prosecuted, 60 have been convicted, and many of them are Somali Americans, the people who have just pulled money away from social service programs that don't belong to them. But the fact is that Somalia has always long been a target of Donald Trump, as has Governor Tim Walz, who has basically, I mean, last Monday he dropped out of the race for re-election because he just, one, the Republicans were attacking him nonstop, and two, he realized he couldn't run for a third term and handle this scandal at the same time. And to be honest, this is on Tim Walz's watch. I mean, this scandal has been going on for years. It started probably during COVID. Millions, if not billions, of money has been stolen. And you know, he has to face up to it, and it really cost him his political future.
Well, so the related to the incident that happened in Minnesota yesterday with ICE, there was a protest last night here in Columbus. There will be another. There's one scheduled again for tonight. So we'll keep an eye on that. You can stay with the WOSU News team for everything happening regarding this, and NPR will be covering it nationally. But the final thing I wanted to ask you related to this is, this incident occurred about a mile-ish from where George Floyd was killed in 2020, that connection is not lost in the commentary here. Do you think this is adding more fuel to a raging fire that's been raging for 5 years?
Well, absolutely. I mean, everything seems, you know, there's so many things I've thought about that. I mean, not only is it George Floyd 5 years, it's also 5 years of January 6th. The insurrection at the Capitol, where everybody who decided to break into the Capitol and, you know, want to hang Mike Pence and get Nancy Pelosi, and everybody has been pardoned for that. So everybody realizes that if you do any kind of violence on behalf of President Trump, you know that the president will take care of you. So I kind of think that ever since George Floyd and ever since January 6th at the Capitol, something has changed in this country, and it's just a steady stream of things moving towards bad. It's just getting worse and worse. Respect for the law, respect for authority, and a feeling that the government, a president, can do what he wants with no retribution. And clearly, people who attacked the Capitol had no retribution. You know, some police officers were killed. There was terrible violence, terrible things that happened to them, and nobody paid the price. So this is what's happened in the last 5 years.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking national politics this hour with Ken Rudin, host of the Political Junkie podcast. And Ken, I really thought I was going to open the show today talking with you about Venezuela, but the news is relentless. And so Venezuela somehow now has become third because late last night, the news broke that a U.S. House committee is subpoenaing Les Wexner in the Epstein case. Representative Robert Garcia got the subpoenas for depositions from Wexner and two other men, Epstein's lawyer and an accountant. Garcia said, quote, "This is an enormous step forward in the investigation to deliver justice to the survivors and truth for the American people." So, Ken, you know, Wexner is well known in Columbus. His name is on many buildings here, and there's been a long time of questions about his ties to Jeffrey Epstein. What are your thoughts on Wexner having to go to Capitol Hill to testify?
Well, the thing about the Epstein thing is just fascinating to me because every time that Donald Trump does something, you know, big or different, even the invasion of Venezuela, they say, oh, it's a distraction from Epstein. I mean, some of that is kind of crazy, but the fact is that Donald Trump would rather talk about anything than his relationship with Epstein and things like that. He says, I have no idea what's in the files, but he says, oh, but Bill Clinton's name is there 73 times. I mean, it's amazing what he knows and what he doesn't know about it. But the fact is, this is not going away. For the longest time, Mike Johnson kept the House from voting on releasing the files, and then suddenly, perhaps with the impetus led by former Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene and other Republicans who said enough is enough, the dam broke, and then suddenly almost every member of the House voted to release them. But there was also a December 19th deadline when everything was supposed to be released, and suddenly the Justice Department says, well, we have millions and millions of files we don't have time to. Meanwhile, everybody knows that they've been going through the files for months, you know, under the Pam Bondi's and Todd Blanche's request. So it's not going away. This is a fascinating development in it. And of course, Donald Trump will always say when he's asked about Epstein, he says, the economy is doing so great. I've saved the Western Hemisphere from the narco terrorist of Nicolas Maduro. And now you're going to ask me about Epstein. Well, we'll see where this leads. Mm-hmm.
So Wexner and his attorney have repeatedly denied any wrongdoing or any involvement in the Epstein case. They did say in reaction to the subpoena that they will fully cooperate. Wexner said he cut ties with Jeffrey Epstein in 2007, but the files released in December do show that there were communications. The two communicated in 2008. So I guess we'll see. I mean, what do you think is happening here? What are they going to try to figure out on, you know, what does this House committee want to figure out if Les Wexner knew something and ignored it, or if he was involved in the cover-up?
Well, I think that's absolutely accurate. The fact that he said, I have had no communication, and it turned out he had communication past the date he said. We should also remember that any investigation by a House committee will be led by Republicans. So Democrats could make their argument that, you know, there's a cover-up going on here, and the Justice Department and Trump are not telling us what they know. But at the same time, if the Republicans are running the show, they can steer the committee and the investigation to where they like. But just like the way when so many Republicans were saying there's no there, and they all voted to release it, obviously there's a lot of pressure from people back home saying, look, that has nothing to do with being a Democrat or Republican. It's about decency, about the treatment of women, and that the fact that the answers should come out, whether Donald Trump is culpable, is liable, or responsible. The fact is that if there's something that's hidden away, it should be released. And I think Republicans know that as well, especially as we get closer and closer to the midterm elections.
Yeah, I read that Trump told members of the Republican Party that if the GOP loses the midterms, that Trump will likely be impeached related to this. Do you think that's true?
Oh, there's absolutely no question about that. And that's why I think what's going to be going on with the elections this year is very, very important, because he already told, when he made that speech to the House Republicans behind closed doors, saying that, you know, if the Democrats win the House, control the House, I'll be impeached. There's no question about that. But there's also, he also said that these elections are fixed, they're fake. And if the feeling from the administration is that the elections are not going to be trusted, we don't know how much interference there will be in the right to vote around the country, and more restrictions might be put on voters around the country. So I'm very nervous about what to expect in the attempt to vote, to get out and vote in 2026. And I think the fact that Trump knows that he will be impeached if the Democrats win the House, he will take measures accordingly. I'm very, very nervous about that. And also the count, they're already cutting back on write-in votes, you know, absentee votes. They say we don't want to count them beyond the election day. There are a lot of little things that they're doing to make sure that the count goes their way it's something that everybody, every journalist in the country should be watching very closely.
Yeah, Ohio did just pass a bill. Governor DeWine signed it in December, right before the holidays, eliminating the grace period for absentee ballots. So now it has to be postmarked before Election Day and delivered. It has to be in the hands of the elections office by Election Day. So
well,
now
that's crazy. Yeah. I mean, what if you're a military person?
Oh, that was exempt. That's exempt.
Okay.
Yes. Okay. Yes, they did exempt that part, but it is saying you're relying on. It's a bill that hurts procrastinators, and it relies heavily on the success of the U.S. Postal Service. So
lots of luck with that. But I mean, but still, one would think that somebody should be able to postmark a vote by Election Day. But if there's a big difference between having it postmarked and mailed by the day and to be received that day, and that's obviously not going to happen.
We are talking about national politics this hour with Ken Rudin, host of the Political Junkie podcast. Coming up, we will talk about Venezuela, and we will also talk about the fifth anniversary of January 6th. That is When All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. We are talking national politics this hour with Ken Rudin, host of the Political Junkie podcast. The unfolding story in Venezuela, ousted President Nicolas Maduro, is our next topic. President Trump is now saying that the U.S. is in charge of Venezuela and threatening possible action in Cuba, Colombia, and Mexico.
Colombia is very sick, too, run by a sick man who likes making cocaine and selling it to the United States, and he's not going to be doing it very long. Yeah. By the way, you have to do something with Mexico. We need Greenland. Cuba is ready to fall. You know?
Yes.
With us this hour, talking about all things national politics, we have the political junkie, Ken Rudin. Ken, thanks again for being here.
Thank you, Amy. I'm just listening to those sound bites, and I'm just shaking my head. I think many people are as well.
Well, when President Trump said he was putting America first, did he mean South America? All the Americas?
Well, you know, it's the Donroe doctrine, right? The Donroe doctrine.
Yes, he's changing the name of the Monroe doctrine to the Donroe. Yeah, yeah,
well,
we got it.
If he could change the Kennedy Center, he can change. He could do whatever he wants.
Indeed.
But the thing is, if you remember when he first ran for president in 2016, he attacked President Bush for the Iraq. He said, I would have been against the Iraq war from the beginning. I'm against nation building. I'm changing governments. And yet, at the same time, all these years, he'd been campaigning for the Nobel Peace Prize, or as he wrote on Truth Social this week, the NOBLE, the Nobel Peace Prize. I guess that's another prize that most people are not aware of. But the fact that there are so many arguments, and to listen to Stephen Miller, the national security guy, talk about, well, you know, Greenland is next because of defending our interest. It really has nothing to do with narco-terrorism. It has nothing to do with drugs. If Nicolas Maduro was arrested because he involved in sending drugs to the United States, why in God's name would Juan Orlando Hernandez, the former president of Honduras, who was convicted in court for distributing tons and tons of cocaine to the United States. He was arrested, he was convicted, he was sent to prison, and then Trump pardoned him. Now, the reason Trump pardoned him, he said, well, Biden was out to get him, and it was an unfair prosecution. So it has nothing to do with drugs. Drugs is basically about oil, and it's clear that what Donald Trump sees about Venezuela is oil and the oil reserves that taking over that country. allows him to do. Now, of course, I don't know how you take over the country. It's several times, twice the size of Iraq. There's a lot of, he's left the Maduro government in place, except for Maduro himself. The vice president is now in charge of it. And obviously the generals who are loyal to Maduro are still there. So he probably thinks it's going to be just a, you know, walk in the park, because the arrest of Maduro was so easy. The arrest should be so easy, but it's obviously not going to be so easy. And the fact that he's done it without any congressional approval at all, and I know Congress is going to, meet about, talk about the War Powers Act, and talk about, keeping the next target from being either, Colombia or Greenland or things like that. It's just that he does what he wants. Congress has no say in it. Apparently, before the action was taken, no Democrat in Congress was informed of what was going to happen. And even immediately after, only Republicans and Newsmax and Fox News were told of it, and no other network. So it's my way, the highway. Again, it's part of the post January 6th. I can get away with anything I want. And apparently, not only can he apparently get away with anything he wants, but how do you attack Russia for what it's doing in Ukraine? How do you attack China for a possible incursion into Taiwan if the United States is overthrowing governments in the Western Hemisphere? So I think our argument, again, for morality and decency fall by the wayside here.
I mean, if he gets us the oil in Venezuela, that would be...
You mean us? You mean you and me?
Us, America.
If he gets
the oil for America, what does that mean? I mean, I guess that's putting America first. I'm sure that's not... I mean, we need it. It's a good thing. I don't know.
Well, he does say that the oil was ours, that when Hugo Chavez and Maduro, when they nationalized American oil companies and, took over the oil industry for itself, it was our oil. And it's like a Panama, we bought it, we paid for it, and it's ours. That was the argument during the Panama Canal Treaty. And that's the argument that Trump is using now, that this was our oil to begin with. So that's why, again, the argument about drugs and what he's doing to this, the amount of drugs Maduro is responsible for, because they're coming into the United States. That's such a bogus argument, given the fact what he's done with the former president of Honduras. It's all about oil. It's all about, and that's what Greenland is. It's not about defense. It's not about, deterrence. It's all about natural resources. And we're obviously the United States cannot, last forever without additional sources. And that's what Venezuela is all about. And that's what Greenland's all about. And what's going on with Greenland and Denmark. And it's just startling to see that, a heretofore loyal ally, longtime ally, Trump is talking about like it's a longtime, antagonistic relationship. And he's named a governor general, somebody to oversee Greenland, which has never happened in U.S. foreign policy before. It's just, and again, Congress, not a word. I don't know how long this will go on. And again, it's kind of good that this is an election year, but I don't know how long Congress can be as silent as they have been.
Do you watch the TV show The Diplomat on Netflix?
I love that show.
Okay. I'm not done with season 3. Don't spoil it for me. But the
you don't know about her dying in the helicopter crash?
Hey, now.
I love that show.
I know. There's the Denmark connection. There's like right now the episode I just watched last night, they were talking all about Denmark and the North Sea and all this stuff. And I was just like, whenever television mirrors reality. Okay. Anyway, I digress, but people should watch The Diplomat. back to this, I remember the fallout from Iraq, and for election after election, people would campaign on whether or not they voted for action in Iraq, and it kept coming up and it wouldn't go away. But that's not going to happen here. There was no vote on Venezuela.
That's exactly true. I was just thinking of that. The reason that one of the biggest reasons why Barack Obama defeated Hillary Clinton for the Democratic nomination in 2008 was Barack Obama, even though he wasn't in Congress, said he was opposed to the U.S. involvement in Iraq. And Hillary Clinton, as did many Democrats, voted for George Bush's policy that came to buy them in the end. So obviously the difference is that there was a vote. And that is a major difference, though, that whatever you think about the incursion into Iraq, George W. Bush did go to Congress for authorization, and he got that authorization. Whereas here, when Trump is bombing these boats that because they're under the suspicion that they have something in their boat, he's killed. He's bombed all these boats. 115, 120 people have been killed. There's no accounting for it. I mean, we just do it because they're suspected of having drugs. It's just the lawlessness and the unconstitutional actions that are being taken are just startling.
I don't even know what to ask next. With Greenland, if we were to acquire Greenland for whatever reason as a, I don't know what word to use, a territory, I'm not even sure the United States like takes good care of the territories they do have. I mean, there's all these questions about, how about Guam and like whether, anyway, I just don't, do we have the capacity to take on Greenland?
Well, do we have the capacity to run Venezuela, as mm-hmm. President Trump said on Saturday, that we're going to be running Venezuela? I don't think people realize what's involved here. First of all, it'll take billions and billions and billions of dollars and years to get the oil industry back to where it was in Venezuela for it to run smoothly. I mean, they're just clearly, and then Trump said his first priority is, you know, the U.S. oil companies and Chevron and all the people who have, you know, who have invested so much money. They get the money, and then eventually we'll let, you know, Venezuela be great again. But eventually is a long time away from now. So I don't think there's a plan for Venezuela, and certainly I don't think there's a plan for Greenland. And to watch Stephen Miller just come out and say that, you know, it's ours. I mean, Denmark has no say in this matter. It's just remarkable. This is all the ugly stereotypes of the United States that's I thought were just thrown away as archaic foreign policy that we would never do again. I mean, you think of all the governments that we've tried to overthrow. You and I.
Yes, it's all on us again. Yeah.
in Latin America, Central America, in Iran, in South Vietnam, our history is ugly like that. And one would have thought that we have gotten. Would have gotten past that, especially when Donald Trump came to the office with the U.S. America First policy. We stay, no foreign wars. I'm not going to make the mistakes that Bush did. And my goodness, he's just on a rampage. And I don't see how he stopped, especially if Congress doesn't say a word.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking national politics this hour with Ken Rudin, host of the Political Junkie podcast. Tuesday marked the fifth anniversary of the January United States Capitol attack. One of his first acts of President Trump's second term was pardoning the January 6th rioters. Here is Special Prosecutor Jack Smith testifying about January 6th.
The decision to bring charges against President Trump was mine, but the basis for those charges rests entirely with President Trump and his actions. Our investigation developed proof beyond a reasonable doubt that President Trump engaged in a criminal scheme to overturn the results of the 2020 election and to prevent the lawful transfer of power.
Ken, so much has happened just in the past year, let alone the past 5 years. But when you look back at January 6th, how do you think it has changed our nation?
I think about that. I've thought about that a lot this week, you know, being the fifth year anniversary. And there is a state of lawlessness that is going on with our government that really began January 6th, even though it was still 4 years before Donald Trump came to power a second time. But there were no consequences. As you said, that the first thing he did when he came to power was to pardon and commute the sentences of all the 1,200 people, 1,600 people that were involved, including people who were responsible for the deaths of Capitol City, you know, Capitol police officers. It's just remarkable. There's no respect for the law. There's no respect for, this is the law and order party that you think of, you know, the House, yes, and they impeached President Trump for the second time, but I think they were like 10 Republicans who voted yes to impeach him, only 10 Republicans, and only 7 to convict him. Had Mitch McConnell done his job, you know, Mitch McConnell saying, well, you know, I'm really not letting Trump get away with anything anymore. It's too late. They had an opportunity to stop him after what has to be one of the darkest days in American history. And yet not only did he live to see another day, but he was elected president again, and half the country supports him. And certainly almost 90%, if more, of the Republican conference and caucus in Congress support him. So it's just sad, and it began a wave of lawlessness that has not been stopped. You know, let me pull away for one quick second. Mm-hmm. Congressman Doug LaMalfa of California died this week, mm-hmm. and Marjorie Taylor Greene resigned from Congress. That leaves the House of Representatives with only 218 Republicans, which is the bare minimum to pass things. And everybody's saying, well, you know, this is really dangerous for Speaker Johnson, because there's only, you know, there's very few Republicans, a very small Republican majority. But Trump doesn't need a Republican majority. He doesn't care how many Republicans there are. He has not gone to Congress for many things. Aside from the big, beautiful bill, Congress has really done nothing. Almost everything has been by executive order. So to say he's an autocrat is, you know, there's no sense, there's no purpose of calling him names, but the fact is he's operating with his own, by his own devices and his own staff and his own cabinet, and you know, dissenters be damned.
We are talking about national politics this hour, and with us for the hour is Ken Rudin, host of the Political Junkie podcast. Coming up, we'll continue our discussion of national politics. We will talk about Minnesota Governor Tim Walz not running for another term, and whether Amy Klobuchar might run for that seat. That is when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jarovich. From the firing of government employees by the Department of Government Efficiency, better known as DOGE, to the destruction of the East Wing, to the passage of One Big Beautiful Bill, 2025 was a busy year for the Trump administration. We're looking at the past year and what could be in store for this coming year, and we're talking national politics with Ken Rudin, host of the Political Junkie podcast. Thanks for being here, Ken.
Thanks, Amy.
So before we get into more current news, I did want to get your take on the second term of President Trump, 1 year in. So we're just about at the 1 year mark. How would you sum up the past year? Is there anything in particular that stood out to you? Because there's so much. So I don't know if there's one you can pick out one thing or sum it up in a word.
No, I would think not much has happened. You know, smooth sailing.
It's been so boring. Yeah.
This is what's fascinating. And when he was first elected in 2016, even though he didn't get the popular vote, when he was first elected, he was new to government. He didn't know how it worked. And he picked a lot of establishment Republicans to run his administration. He wound up firing many of them, including Secretary of State and Attorney General and all those things. But basically, there were a lot of people who said no to him. What's happened in this one, when you have Robert Kennedy Jr. with health policy, with Pete Hegseth in defense, with Kristi Noem and all these other people, nobody says no to him. He just, you know, they're all yes men and yes women, and who are willing to do whatever he says, including stuff, you know, I mean, what Pam Bondi, if you look at any testimony that Pam Bondi gives before Congress, she refuses to answer a single question. And it's just remarkable. You know, you think of Watergate and how, you know, John Mitchell, the attorney general, and others went down and went to prison because obviously you couldn't sustain such illegal behavior. But not only is there such illegal behavior going on now, but it's rewarded by the president. So he's emboldened to do what he wants. There seems to be no hesitation. The fact that they're openly talking about, well, Colombia, you're next, or something like that, and the fact that Stephen Miller, here I go again, about talking about Greenland, Denmark has no say in it. This is just nothing. I mean, I've always said that everything Trump does is unprecedented. We've never seen it in our lifetime. But this is going beyond that. It's just there's no accountability. And again, with elections coming up, you don't know if Republicans will get a spine to do it. But somebody either they stop him or they don't stop him, and he continues. And if that's what happens, you don't know what's next. You don't know what's next, including the ability to vote and the ability to go on with constitutional liberties.
Yeah, that's interesting that you talked about the staff, because I can remember working here in 2017, and there would be NPR special coverage every time that there was a change in a cabinet secretary, and it became exhausting because it happened a lot over that year. NPR's kind of changed the way they do special coverage because now everything is unprecedented and special.
And yet he went a year without replacing one member of the cabinet.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Mike Waltz, moved from national security or something to UN ambassador, but nobody was fired. And the reason nobody was fired is because he picked people who think the way he does. And so there's no reason to fire anybody.
So he learned to hire differently. That's what he learned in his 4 years between the two terms. All right.
Exactly.
Well, in other political news, you mentioned this earlier. I wanted to swing back to it. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, who rose to national prominence as Kamala Harris's vice presidential running mate, he ended his run for a third term as governor. Let's listen.
I have every confidence that if I gave it my all, we would win the race. But as I reflect on this moment with my family and my team over the holidays, I came to the conclusion that I can't give a political campaign my all.
So Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar might run. If she does and wins, she could be the state's first female governor. What would it mean to leave Washington to govern Minnesota? Is that a good political move for her?
That's a great question. By the way, my Political Junkie podcast, a new one which will be out tomorrow, is really most all about Minnesota and what's going on there. And all the machinations between Klobuchar and Tim Walz and things like that. I hope people tune into that. But anyway, it's fascinating. You think, well, why would you give up a seat in the Senate? She's in her fourth term. She's won by overwhelming majorities. And every time she's run, she's very, very popular. Why give that up? But if you notice that it's going on a lot in around the country, the governor, Senator Tommy Tuberville of Alabama is running for the Senate, running for governor. He wants to give up Washington. Michael Bennett in Colorado is going to run for governor. He's a senator. Senator Marsha Blackburn of Tennessee is giving it up and running for the governor. Lisa Murkowski in Alaska is talking about giving up the Senate seat and running for governor. I think Congress seems to be so irrelevant lately with the Trump administration that what's the point of going to Washington? What's the point of Mr. or Mrs. Smith going to Washington? It's not a big deal anymore because they have no say. They have no power. And it's so ugly. And both Democrats and Republicans will tell you that it's gotten so toxic and ugly in Washington that maybe coming home is a better way to do it. So that I think that's part of Amy Klobuchar's calculation.
Yeah, maybe she'll have more pull, be able to get more done if she focuses on just the state instead of the whole country.
She'll be number one. Right now she's number three of the minority party, and it's very unlikely that the Democrats will win control of the Senate in 2026, although stranger things have happened. But if that's the case, if that's what she's expecting, why go through, why give up this opportunity to come home and be number one?
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about national politics this hour with Ken Rudin, host of the Political Junkie podcast. In other election news, Representative Jasmine Crockett is running for U.S. Senate in Texas. Crockett has become a rising star for the Democrats. What do you think of that run for the Senate?
That's a fascinating race to watch. I mean, originally, there's a guy named James Tirico, who's a very a Baptist minister, who's very popular with Democrats and Republicans. Look, first of all, Democrats for years have been saying we're going to finally win in Texas because the demographics are changing, but it never happens. And the exciting thing for Democrats is that the lieutenant governor of I'm sorry, the lieutenant governor of no, the attorney general of Texas is running against John Cornyn, who's such a right winger that the Democrats think they have a shot. But as Jasmine Crockett, as much as de as many much as Democrats love her because she's so outspoken, I mean, go to YouTube and look at her fights with Marjorie Taylor Greene. They're legendary. I mean, they're pathetic, but they're legendary at the same time. But the fact is, no, Republicans are not going to vote for her in November. She's not going to get in. There are not enough Democrats alone to get her elected. And so while all the progressive left loves Jasmine Crockett, I don't think she helps the Democrats win a Senate seat, but she's fascinating to watch.
Another topic, Secretary of Defense or Secretary of War, depending on what you want to call him, Pete Hegseth, is censuring Arizona Senator Mark Kelly with plans to cut his retirement pay over a video the senator took part in telling service members that they have the right to refuse to execute illegal orders. This was Mark Kelly's response earlier this week on The Daily Show.
That is what they're trying to do. I am going to do everything in my power not to allow them to do that.
Okay, so what do you think of Secretary Hegseth's punishment of Senator Kelly?
The whole administration seems to be one of retribution. Let's prosecute Jack Smith, as we heard from him earlier. Let's prosecute Jack Smith. Let's prosecute James Comey. Let's prosecute Letitia James, the Attorney General of New York. If you're Pete Hegseth, let's go after people like Mark Kelly and have them. How dare they say things that are contrary to you to what we believe in? So this is just shows the arrogance of an administration that feels they can and that they can, I guess legally they can, reduce Mark Kelly's rank, Senator Kelly's rank, and cut his pay. I assume that would be reversed should, God forbid, a Democrat ever take over the White House. But it just shows the kind of stuff that they're doing. It's a retribution and of, let's go after our enemies. And so far, it's working.
Is that the worst way he can punish him, like cutting his retirement pay? I mean,
Well,
not that I'm saying that, but it's just is like, okay.
sure. But I mean, there are a lot of people that there are a lot of people in the FBI lifelong, I mean, year career long people who have given their all to the country to work for the FBI or the military who were summarily fired by the administration because they didn't back the policies and things like that. Either they had the gall to investigate Donald Trump, which was their job, before Trump came to power the second time, but they were fired from it or moved to lesser positions. There's just so much, as they said, it's a campaign of retribution that Donald Trump promised if he was reelected in 2024, and he's fulfilled that promise.
We were talking about Congress earlier, about how Congress hasn't been doing much and everything that's happening is through executive order. The threat of government shutdowns has been a regular occurrence. So do you how likely do you think that another government shutdown is on the horizon here?
I don't know. I didn't think the last one was going to happen because they always threaten to ha happen and then they always come up with a solution at the last second. I don't know what they're thinking anymore. I think there's so much disillusionment, and I think the Republicans paid for. I mean, at the time, I mean, it was very unpopular. But who's talking about the last government shutdown? People have forgotten, even though there was so many people out of work and lost salaries and things like that. But you think of all the other distractions to Epstein that I mean, I don't really know the answer to that question. I just don't know what they're planning. But you're absolutely right. The possibility of another shutdown is right in front of us. And I just shrug my shoulders of the fact that Congress allows this to happen so often. I don't know what's next. Could we speak for one quick second about Vivek Ramaswamy and
Oh,
what he's,
yeah.
because this fascinates me. I mean, we all know that he ran for president in 2024 as a an anti-woke, Trump loyalist. But the fact is, he's playing a huge role in the Republican Party, speaking out against racism and prejudice. Of course, being an Indian American, he's running for governor of Ohio, as I'm sure you know.
I've heard of him.
yeah. Try to find his name on a bumper sticker. You need a very large car. But the fact is, he's speaking courageously in a party that more and more racist and homophobic and ugly things that used to be whispered are now out in the open or spread on social media. And Ramaswamy, unlike Vice President Vance, who seems to see no problem with that, he said, look, this is terrible. This is a threat to democracy. It's a threat to the Constitution. And the Republican Party is going to find itself in big trouble if they keep going on this way. Now, there's a lot of pushback. Nick Fuentes, who seems to be Tucker Carlson's best friend, you know, the anti-Semite, Nick Fuentes, the anti-Semite and avowed racist, has attacked Ramaswamy, saying, who are you to tell me what a real American is? So there is an ugly spat going on in the Republican Party between racist, homophobic, ugly, bigoted comments and fewer people than usual trying to stop it. And Ramaswamy is leading that effort, which is interesting.
I don't know if you saw the video. There was an interesting video of Ramaswamy doing an event. I can't remember if it was with the Center for Christian Virtue, but that's what they were talking about. It was the Center for Christian Virtue. And someone in the audience asked him a question of like why the Center for Christian Virtue was endorsing him, because he's Hindu, right? And basically this person was like, shouldn't we be backing a Christian? And it's a very interesting back and forth that the two of them have, but it ends up with him, Ramaswamy, calling the young gentleman up onto the stage and reading an article from Ramaswamy's pocket constitution and saying, you know, the religion doesn't matter and that kind of thing. But I do find it interesting that, you know, groups like the Center for Christian Virtue are, you know, we had a Christian running against Ramaswamy, Attorney General Dave Yost, but they backed Ramaswamy. It's kind of like, it doesn't matter that he's Hindu. They're picking who they think will win. Is that, what do you think there?
Well, but the fact that it also is that he said, and he said this in a New York Times op-ed a week or so ago, that basically since he launched his campaign for governor, he's been deluged with anti-Indian slurs, that he's just shocked that people have come out of the woodwork and under the rocks to just come out and just blast him for his religion. And again, this is not something I would have seen from somebody like him, given the fact that he was seemed to be down the line Trumper in 2024, actually, when he ran for president. So it's just fascinating to watch. And of course, we can't, you know, one should remember that Vice President Vance's wife is also Hindu, and she's also been attacked by many of these groups, where at the same time, Vance has dismissed the bigotry as like there was a young Republican thing where a lot of people posted the ugliest kinds of slurs. And he said, oh, it's just, you know, college boys, talking, that's the way college kids are. Meanwhile, these college kids were 35, 40, 45 years old, so it was hardly children. But the fact is, there's a thing going on in the Republican Party between what decency is all about, and Ramaswamy has clearly picked one side of it.
Yeah, it's also interesting because just this week, Ramaswamy announced that he's not going to handle his social media anymore. He's going to leave it to his communications team, and he's not going to be the one to actually write the things. I found that surprising because it seems like some politicians really enjoy engaging in that platform.
Well, if you look at Gavin Newsom's team that's doing its responses on social media to Donald Trump, it is getting under Fox News and the Republicans and Trump's skin. So if he can have the kind of brilliant team that Gavin Newsom has in California, he'll be better off.
Well, we have just about 2 minutes left, and I guess we should take a minute to talk about the person in Ohio running against Ramaswamy. So we have Dr. Amy Acton on the Democratic side. Both of them announced their running mates this week. So we have the tickets are set here in Ohio. What do you think about a Democrat winning the governor's race here in Ohio in less than a minute?
Well, I don't think, if you ask me who I predict, I think the Republicans keep the Senate seat with John Husted and the governorship with Ramaswamy. I've seen polls for the governor's race between Acton and Ramaswamy that either have her up by a point. And of course, with an unpopular President Trump, if that's the case in November, it could help the Democrats. But right now, I see the Democrats haven't even picked candidates for a lot of statewide offices. There's still not a strong bench for the Democrats. Again, it's a great opportunity. It's an open Senate, an open governorship. And Trump's unpopularity, but she has her work cut out for her.
We have been speaking this hour with Ken Rudin, host of the Political Junkie podcast. And Ken, you said you'll have a new Political Junkie episode tomorrow. Is that right?
Yeah, yes, and it's a good one. Unlike all the others
all
that
the, I was going to say, aren't they all good ones? Ken, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Amy.
And you've been listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jarovich. And if you missed any part of today's show, you can listen back at wosu.org/allsides. Subscribe to the podcast, and every episode is in our free mobile app. This is 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us.